You're with Steve Austin on ABC Radio Brisbane.
Brisbane's very own star man Mark Rigby, the curator of the Sir Thomas Brisbane Planetarium, is retiring after 36 years. Now, you would have heard Mark dozens of times. Crikey, it must be hundreds of times. How many times have you been on radio? Do you have? Let me ask you, Mark Rigby, how many times have you been on radio talking about the universe?
Even before I was curator, or assistant curator before that.
Really?
Yeah, I was on radio to do with Skylab in 1979.
And this is when it came plummeting back to Earth and everyone was wondering if they're going to be hit by it.
Yeah, I was actually with Paul Bongiorno and he had it up to Butterham hoping it would come down over southeast Queensland. It could have. It came down less than one orbit after that.
Okay.
And then I did total solar eclipse in Port Moresby with Paul, actually, in 1983. I've done it with Spencer House. And
my goodness. You've done it with everyone.
And I've talked from overseas, live, during launches, even from Baikonur Cosmodrome on one occasion.
The Russian Cosmodrome, really?
Yeah, I think I'd...
Or the Kazakh, Cosmodrome.
Yeah, I might have done that with Craig Zonka.
Craig Zonka. Yeah. Well, Mark is calling it quits. He's helped everyone throughout the ABC listening area for many years sort of navigate their way through the universe, the stars and things in space, from space shuttle launches, we've just heard, to comets flying by. Why have you decided to retire from what must be one of the most interesting paid jobs on planet Earth?
Actually, when I went there, I thought, I'm getting paid for my hobby. Don't tell them.
Yeah, don't tell them. Yeah, I feel the same way about radio. I tell people I get paid to play music and talk to people. Don't tell anyone.
But 36 years is a long time, and for 17 and a half years of that, I overlapped with Jeff Ryder, the first curator. And in fact, Jeff and I both applied for the job in 1977, February. They thought they'd open the planetarium later that year. In the end, it opened 24th of May 1978. But I missed out to Jeff, and frankly, I said it at a sort of farewell the other day that he was the best person for the time. I was 22. He was 7 years older, more experienced. So they got the benefit of Jeff, and I hope that I took over as curator in 2002 when Jeff retired. And it's been a fair while, almost two decades as curator, and technology's changed dramatically. Mm-hmm. We started with a Zeiss star projector from behind the Iron Curtain from Zeiss in East Germany. And in the early 2000s, went to digital.
So let me just go back. So the first projector you had was from behind the Iron Curtain during the Cold War. How did you get it here?
Well, they still bid. And the first projection planetarium was from Zeiss in Jena in 1923. We're coming up to 200 years in a couple of years of the first shows.
Okay.
And was known as the Wonder of Jena. And in the 70s, Zeiss bid from there. There was Zeiss Oberkochen in East Germany.
So and Zeiss are a lens-making company these days.
They were top-notch on optical.
Right, okay.
Top-notch. Yeah. And Jeff actually was sent by the Brisbane City Council to behind the Iron Curtain for some training.
Fantastic. Was that exciting for him?
Yeah, and that was different times back then. But we've moved on technology in the 21st century, and those star projectors could only show you the heavens from Earth-based. Right. Now we can fly anywhere in the universe, and I just love flying and down to the surface almost of the Moon or Mars or the landing site of Perseverance that landed the other day on Mars. And also I'm looking back because in more recent years I've looked more at our planet.
And really? Because I was going to say David Attenborough sort of helps us look at planet Earth, but you help us look exactly the opposite direction to all the other planets in the universe.
It does, and in Saturday Night Live, currently Saturday Afternoon Live, or Come Fly With Us, which I started doing in the school holidays, we look at Earth because the more we've looked out, the more you appreciate what we've got and how we've got to protect what we've got. And it is the only world in the universe that we know has life and can support life, and Mars might support us in the future for colonies and things, but there's no place like home.
Mark Rigby is my guest. He's been running the Sir Thomas Brisbane Planetarium for a number of years, and he's retiring. What's the most unexplained thing in the universe for you, Mark Rigby?
Where does one start?
Right.
You know, I'd love to know in my lifetime whether there's even life elsewhere in the solar system. You know, whether it's microbial under the surface of Mars or whether it's in subterranean oceans on some of the moons of Jupiter or Saturn, but it would be great to find out if there's life beyond our solar system, you know, to actually find Earth-like planets out there through indirect means and know that they're inhabited through what we detect in their atmospheres. Whether we actually ever get signals, which have been searched for now for since about 1960, radio signals, that'd be a real buzz if that came through and we knew that and the impact on our thinking.
This is an unusual question, but it's been widely covered. In fact, the Pentagon in the United States has been told they must decommission within a month or so now their report on UFOs because they've got a whole lot of, you know, fighter pilot footage of unexplained objects. Have you ever seen a UFO in your 35, 36 years and more?
I say this carefully, yes, because when I was a kid, I saw things in the sky. I didn't know what they were. They appeared to be flying, so they were unidentified. So by that thinking, I've seen a UFO. It didn't mean it was extraterrestrial.
Yes.
And often it could be Venus, it could be a weather balloon. In that case, I think it was
usually they are weather balloons in some cases, aren't they?
Yeah, or you see an aircraft so high and you don't see the wings or something, but which I think was the case when I was a kid of what I saw.
These days they're likely to be drones, I think. But it's intriguing to me that, you know, the US has told, you know, the Pentagon they do have to actually release their report. And I wondered whether, you know, blokes like you are sort of thinking about what they might reveal.
I don't think it's going to reveal extraterrestrials here.
I'm ruining all my fun.
I mean, astronomers, those in the field, whether it's in research or in my case communicating, we would love it to be for real.
Yeah.
It's just only realistically looking at it. It doesn't mean we're not saying that there might not be intelligent life out there. We have, a century ago, the Milky Way galaxy was the universe to us. Hundreds of thousands of millions of stars, even more planets. Now we know the Milky Way is just one of hundreds of thousands of millions of galaxies. And are we the only ones in that? And if we are, we better look after this world.
In my mind, I know nothing about the universe, but in my mind, the Hubble telescope, I don't know whether you could say changed everything, but it certainly brought the universe so much closer and gave it a greater sort of depth and sort of vivid life in my mind. How do you see the successful placing in orbit of the Hubble telescope?
That was a real game changer for the public when it was launched in April of 1990, and just months before I was standing next to it in a white room, a clean room at Kennedy Space Center, and looking at that and thinking, what will that do to our understanding of the universe? And there have been amazing discoveries that have come out of it, but part of it has been the visual side for people and the internet use and seeing remarkable imagery of our solar system and beyond. And I think that just captured a lot of people's imagination. And we've got other ones coming up, the James Webb Space Telescope.
Tell me about that. I'm ignorant of that one. Tell me about it.
That's the most expensive astronomical instrument ever constructed, and it better launch successfully maybe next year because it has blown out. It's something of the order of maybe getting towards $10,000 million.
Crikey. You could probably, 10,000 million, isn't that 10 billion?
Yes,
That's $10 billion US.
You could probably have two fully fledged US aircraft carriers fully equipped for that. And that is a lot in one basket when they launch it, not from the US actually, but from French Guiana, from the European side.
And what's its role? What's its mission?
Once again, to go beyond Hubble and other ones. And it's remarkable what can be done from Earth now to stabilize images and everything with technology. But for some wavelengths, parts of the light spectrum, if you like, you get filtered by the Earth's atmosphere. So you have to get some instruments above. And we have to get that one about 1.5 million kilometres away from Earth. You can't repair it if something goes wrong. Hubble was in low Earth orbit. So there were a number of missions to repair. Because when it was launched, it was bad news eventually. They found it was out of focus, essentially.
I remember that, yeah.
And there was a remarkable mission.
Of the shuttles went up, I think. Was the space shuttle went up and fixed it?
They went up and a crew did a remarkable job of spacewalks and repaired it. But since then, they upgraded it as well and put new instruments in it. So it was upgraded over the years until the shuttle stopped flying.
If I could send you into space, because now civilians would like to go into space if you pay money. Would you do it, Mark?
I had my financial advisor do my future until I, you know, I'm sick. I'm actually not retired yet. I'm on long service leave.
Long service, okay, right, okay.
And my retirement date is the week I turn 67 in August.
Right.
And but I did, as most people should do when they're planning retirement, get the figures looked and what are you going to do? And,
yes.
And I did ask him to put in an amount for perhaps a flight on Virgin Galactic in a few years' time, hoping the price might come down. It's about $250,000 US. But you've got Jeff Bezos with his Blue Origin launching. You've got Elon Musk up to other things. So I'm hoping if it comes down to something, if they said you could go for $50,000 US tomorrow, Mark, I'd go. $250,000 US is a bit. So
you can't do it.
I'm on a intersecting thing. It's sort of the cost coming down, my age and my health, my age going up, my health going down, and where that intersects, I don't want it to be too far along the timeline.
My guest is Mark Rigby. Mark has been the Brisbane Planetarium curator for many years. He's on long service leave, which will then eventually roll into a retirement. This is ABC Radio Brisbane. Steve Austin's my name. So who do you rate more highly, Zuckerberg or Elon Musk? Or someone else out there working on a space program? You know, the Virgin Atlantic, Richard Branson's mob? Who do you rate most highly?
In the space field, you've really got Branson, suborbital for tourists, and also launching from aircraft and
yep.
putting satellites up. You've got Elon Musk, who has done amazing things, not always to his optimistic timetables.
Yes.
But, I mean, the sight of boosters coming back and landing out in the Atlantic on barges or back on launch pads with precision on the X they have there for SpaceX, that is remarkable reuse and lowering the cost. And that's always been the problem, the cost. It's like flying across the Pacific and throwing away your jumbo jet or your Dreamliner with every flight. And that's what's been happening since they started launching satellites. So, and Jeff Bezos, they are pouring a huge amount of their own money into that.
Yep.
And part of the idea of Musk is don't put all your eggs in one basket. Don't rely on just planet Earth. Become a multi-planet civilization. And the only place in the solar system we can do that, although it's a cold, dry desert world, mm-hmm. is Mars. And Musk wants to die there, but not on impact. And
yes.
So I wouldn't mind getting, if someone said, Mark, you can go anywhere in the solar system, or maybe nearby, I would love to go to the moon to my favorite landing site of Apollo days. It's not Apollo 11, it's Apollo 15. And they landed at the base of mountains next to a collapsed lava tube. They were the first to drive an electric car on the moon. It was the first really full on.
The moon buggy.
The moon buggy.
With those big, big bulbous wheels, I remember it.
Yes, wire-framed.
Yeah, wire-framed.
Yeah.
Extraordinary. I saw a great documentary, on this is a complete aside, on Netflix called The Last Man to the Moon.
That is marvellous.
It was fantastic.
That's Gene Cernan, the last man to walk on the moon who died just a few years ago. Wonderful to talk to. And that one you said, Last Man, is a wonderful insight into
the I had a tear in my eye, Mark. I don't even know why. It was just so moving.
I get tears every time I watch it.
Really? Is that a fact? There you go.
Yeah, yeah.
Couple of blokes in the studio here revealing their deep, in the, you know, sort of sensitive side.
We're and his daughter, Tracy, she and her mother, I go to Space Fest when I can in Tucson, but a couple of years ago, last year was cancelled, but they had a session with two wives from the Apollo days and two daughters, and those Apollo 12 and 17, and Tracy is the daughter of Gene Cernan we're talking about.
Yep.
And he actually put her initials into the dust there and everything.
The dust of the moon.
On the moon, and he talked about it being, I'm not religious, but he talked about being on the moon for 3 days there was like being on God's porch,
yeah.
looking back at Earth and blocking it out with your thumb.
Yeah.
And everything you know, everyone that ever lived, everything is on that little blue marble,
yeah.
that oasis in space.
Yeah, very moving. Now, I've got to wrap it up in a moment, but back to you and saying goodbye to your job. I understand you lost a very special member of your work family recently. Tell me about Jean Falconer, please.
Wonderful woman. Born in 1930, died just a couple of weeks ago, just under 2 weeks ago at 91. And Jean was a friend of Clem Jones, and he was a key part to pushing the planetarium ahead. Mm-hmm. Jean was also a Metro girl. back in the late 40s, 50s, there was the Regent Theatre and the Metro Theatre, and the Metro girls were renowned for their beauty and their legs and everything, but not to frighten.
Is this when they used to go around selling cigarettes on trays in cinemas?
Jean didn't do that, but she was in the booking office and ushering. So she started, she did office work too, but then she had kids who grew up and scattered around the world, as they are now. And so she joined in June 88, Expo year. And she worked for 27 and a half years at the planetarium until she was 85 and a half, oldest employee in Brisbane City Council at the time. Then she was about a month out from retiring when she had a bad accident. But I've sort of looked out for Jean, and even if I was going to New York or something, I'd take her and say, you want to go and see your daughter in upstate New York? And sometimes her brother had died, and I said, we'll go the long way. So we went to Singapore, Egypt, England, New York, San Francisco, and all that sorts of things. And her grandson worked at Pixar, so we went into Pixar and The Incredibles. And she was wonderful. The best thing was she was the best front of house PR person, and you don't probably get many places where the patrons come, whether it be school teachers, little kids, or general public, and they'd see her and they'd just go up and give her a great hug. Or she'd bring little kids sometimes if she thought they were really keen on space. She'd say, I'm taking you to the curator's office, the playroom, the toy room.
Right.
Because I had rockets and lunar globes, Mars globes and everything. So I was deeply affected. I didn't get much work done in my last 2 weeks, but I did some great shows on Friday and my last public one, scheduled one, because I can't break. I started as a kid in astronomy in the 60s, early to mid-60s, and I can't cut away. So I'm hoping I'll do specials. There are ones in my mind, Fly Me to the Moon and things. And
listen, you've got listeners telling me they want to know if you'll do sort of speaking events and what have you, and because you've got all these stories. Like, you've done all this stuff where you regularly go to all the big space events and what have you. You don't realise the body of stories you have in your mind that people are fascinated with.
Yeah, one thing I missed out on, and I would have loved to have done it, you talked about Gene Cernan, but there are others that I've met, like Charlie Duke on Apollo 16, who went to the moon, but he was the capsule communicator for Apollo 11 landing.
Okay.
And there have been tours of them, and I would have loved to have emceed those tours because of... I was not a good boy in school. I skipped school when Apollo missions happened, and I had my transistor radios in my ear to keep following. So I was a bad boy in school.
Well, you've got to come back and tell me some more of those bad boy stories, because you and Elon Musk are both bad boys, and you're both looking to the stars. Happy retirement. I'd love to see you again. Thanks for coming in. Best of luck for the future.
Thanks, Steve.
You're with Steve Austin on ABC Radio Brisbane.